From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. Happy Friday. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we explore why the Pasadena Museum of California Art is shutting down. Then the FX series Pose is about the 1980s underground culture for gay and transgender youth. Its co-creator explains what it was like to hear a lot of no's before he got a yes.
When you're telling a story that is coming from a very personal place, it's difficult to be in a room where you're being told this story has no value, because the subtext to that is you have no value.
And the real-life story of a baseball player turned World War II spy. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
And National Geographic's Jane, a documentary by Brett Morgan profiling conservationist Jane Goodall using more than 100 hours of lost archival footage. Emmy eligible in all categories. NatGeoTV.com/FYC.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The Pasadena Museum of California Art opened in 2002 and built a solid reputation for featuring a wide range of art from the Golden State, everything from traditional landscape painting to cutting-edge contemporary work. The museum was founded by philanthropists and collectors Robert and Arlene Altman. They commissioned the museum's three-story building near Pasadena's Old Town, and they actually live in an apartment on the premises. But this week, the Altmans and the rest of the board of directors voted to close down the museum come October. The entire staff will be laid off, including executive director Susanna Smith-Bautista, who has been in her post for less than 18 months. She had been trying to bring the museum's practices up to standards commonly in place at arts institutions. To better understand how we got here, I spoke with board chairman Jim Crawford, and he began with his origins with the museum.
So I've been chairman since 2014. I was attracted to the museum because we went to, I believe it was the opening show in 2002, and I was so impressed with the sort of focus on California art from, you know, the plein air period to today's modernist period, and showcasing that in one place.
Obviously, you made a very dramatic decision in the last couple of weeks. Was this something that was a long time coming? What were the factors that necessitated the step of closing the museum down?
We were started by our founders, the Altmans, and they built this building and they live in the building. Over the years, the museum has thrived with several directors. But it's always been a financial challenge to meet the budgets and keep things going, and we've been able to do that. Over the last few years, the challenge has become a little bit greater. We don't have an endowment, and so, you know, we basically survive day to day. And it got to the point where it was a real struggle to meet the budget. Obviously, this isn't a brand new problem. It's been with us for a while, and the budget originally was kind of balanced by donors and museum members and the board. And we also have, if you know the building, we have a third floor that we used to rent out, and that supplemented our income. The Altmans had intended to give the building to the museum at some point, so I hate to say that was the issue. I think it's a combination of that plus, you know, the just it's very difficult to raise funds for the arts. That's just kind of a given, and I think we've been very lucky. And you know, it's our hope that at some future time this will come back to life.
Was the museum essentially a tenant in the building? In other words, was it leasing space from the Altmans where you'd have to pay rent and take care of improvements and repairs and things like that?
That's correct. We had a lease on the building. But I think it is important that people realize that there was every intent to gift the building to the museum.
Why couldn't that happen now? I mean, if it was a choice between giving the museum the building now and closing down, was that just not an option for the Altmans?
That wasn't an option.
I was looking at some past years in the museum. I was looking at the 2015 tax filing that you had, where you lost, as a museum, almost $170,000. When you had years like that, how did you cover those shortfalls? And did those shortfalls create problems in terms of attracting donors who looked at past years about how the museum was doing financially?
They would be covered by, aggressive fundraising efforts on the behalf of our staff and the board. You know, every year was a little bit of a struggle because there is no endowment. I mean, my own personal view is that you have to look at what this museum was doing. You have to get excited about it, and you have to be willing to take a little bit of a risk, and that's what our museum did. And I can't tell you how proud I am of how far we've gotten. So would that turn off donors? Maybe it did. But I think all of us are very pleased and thrilled with what we're able to accomplish.
When you're thinking about the decisions that have to be made and how you make certain decisions about the museum's future going forward, how do you balance the idea of what is best for the Oltmans versus what is best for the museum?
You know, I don't think of it as an us or a them, I guess. I think of this as a collaboration. And the Oltmans are the ones that started this. They made this possible. And in order to get from here to there, you have to respect their timeline. That, unfortunately, wasn't the best thing for the museum. If the building could have come to us sooner, that probably would have opened some doors with donors and foundations that would have allowed us to continue. That's purely speculation, but that's my thought.
What happens to the staff? I think you recently hired a new executive director. What happens to her, and what happens to the rest of the employees at the museum?
We're going through some planning now in terms of how to wind down the operation. It's our goal to keep the nonprofit status open so that at some future time the museum can come back to life, that's possible. So I don't have a specific set of things that will happen. I would say that our new director, Susanna, has done a great job. She's brought a level of professionalism that was needed. And so I'm personally very disappointed that we're not going to see this through for a few more years.
Jim Crawford is the board chairman of the Pasadena Museum of California Art. Jim, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And just one point of clarification. While the Pasadena Museum of California Art technically leases its space from founders Robert and Arlene Oltman, the building's owners made the rent an annual in-kind donation to the museum. Coming up, the TV series Pose recreates the 1980s underground scene known as ball culture.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's series One Strange Rock, hosted by Will Smith and executive produced by Darren Aronofsky and Newtopia. An elite ensemble of astronauts tells the unexpected and unprecedented story of Earth, filmed across 900,000 plus miles, 45 countries, 6 continents, and outer space. Emmy eligible in all categories. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information. Don't just consider. Explore.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The new FX series Pose explores the glamorous house ball scene in 1980s New York City. The houses started out as self-selected families for ostracized gay and transgender youth, but also as a sort of team. The houses competed against each other in underground balls, which today have become more mainstream, where the judging is based on dress, dance, and attitude. Stephen Canals co-created the series, along with Brad Falchuk and Ryan Murphy. They've made television history with Pose by casting more transgender actors in regular roles than any previous scripted series. When I spoke with Stephen Canals about Pose, he explained the ball scene for the uninitiated.
In a ball competition, you have members of competing houses. And for those folks who aren't familiar with the house culture, the house ball culture, houses are essentially your chosen family, often led by a mother, who is typically but not always a trans woman, who provides moral and social support for rejected LGBTQ youth. You know, in essence, she provides a safety net. And so at a ball, you have members from competing houses who come together and compete against one another in these categories that are traditionally rooted in fashion and music and dance, and they compete for trophies and for glory. And on a ballroom floor, you can be whoever you want to be.
Even though we see a lot of competition on the ballroom floor in your series, it's not just really about the competitions. It's about the community, and it's about the surrogate families, these houses. What did you find when you were researching that era and how these houses came together and what they meant to the people who were members of them?
Well, there's a rich history to the ballroom culture. Michael Roberson, who is one of our ballroom consultants, is just a plethora of knowledge. And ballroom culture really roots back well into the 1920s. But the house culture, the house ballroom culture, which we capture in Pose, and which I think most modern viewers and your listeners will probably be more familiar with, really began in the 1970s. On the shoulders of Crystal LaBeija, who was a trans woman who was competing in similar balls back in the 1960s. At the time, they didn't have the language for transness, and so they referred to them as drag balls. And so you had a lot of trans women as well as drag queens, but it was primarily focused on white queens. And so Crystal LaBeija, as a black woman, decided to splinter off. And so she moved to Harlem and started the house culture.
I think there is an assumption, and it's an assumption that really is not grounded in a lot of history, that the LGBTQ community has always been unified and banded together. Because there's a storyline that emerges in the second episode of the series about the outsider status of trans women. There's a character named Blanca who is repeatedly kicked out of a gay bar where the men, who are almost entirely white, reject her. I want to play a clip from the first time that she's at the bar with another trans woman.
This one's on me. Then you gotta go. I got 10 guys in here asking me if it's drag night.
I'm sorry, we're not in drag. We're women.
Even better. We don't like women in here. This is a gay bar.
Well, I want to see a manager.
Girl, why you always gotta pick fights you can't win?
Because these are the ones worth fighting.
So I want to ask you a little bit about that scene and why it's important to include and how it really challenges, I think, a lot of the assumptions that people might have about the community at that time.
Well, I think one of the things that we discussed in the writer's room, and our writer's room is fantastic, and so I just have to say, you know, all of Pose really would not have happened had it not been for the hard work and tenacity of Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk and Janet Mock and Our Lady J, and we really formed our own house, if you will, in the writer's room. But one of the things that we talked a lot about in the room was that, you know, there are periods between the alphabet soup that is LGBTQIA, and there is this assumption that there is support amongst the community for one another, when in truth, and the reality is that there's still a lot of, specifically if we're looking at the transgender community, there's still a lot of misinformation out there. And within any marginalized community, you can still be othered. You know, like, I live in the intersection of identity. I'm not just a queer man, but I'm also Afro-Latin. You know, and so how does my race impact how people then interact with me apart from my sexual orientation? And so I think that was one of the important pieces that we wanted to unpack throughout the show, but specifically with that episode.
We're talking with Stephen Canals. He's the co-executive producer and co-creator of Pose. You wrote about the history of the show in the Daily Beast, and you wrote about how you got your MFA from UCLA, which is where you came up with the idea for Pose. And you said, and I'm quoting you now, "I had the opportunity to meet plenty of executives. I quickly realized that while Pose opened doors, it didn't keep me in the room."
I was entering rooms and meeting with individuals who just didn't have a lot of information about what it means to be transgender. And so as a result, I would walk into rooms where I was having to educate and explain what it means to be trans. I was having to educate and explain what the ballroom community is. And I felt that I was spending so much time building and explaining the world. And by the time I get to explaining and talking about the story and the characters, their eyes are just glazed over. Also, more often than not, the very specific questions that I was receiving from executives was, the story's very niche and I'm having a hard time understanding who the audience is for a show like this. Where does a show like this live? Why does a show have to be so urban? Can it be a modern era piece? You know, and then there were execs, to be perfectly honest, who were just blatantly transphobic and racist and would say, you know, there are too many trans people, there are too many gay people, it's too black, it's too brown, it's a period piece. It was difficult because one of the lessons that I learned while I was at UCLA was that it's important to infuse every narrative with a little bit of yourself. And so when you're telling a story that is coming from a very personal place, it's difficult to be in a room where you're being told this story has no value because the subtext to that is you have no value.
And what did Ryan and Brad say? How did that change the trajectory of this story?
Well, I should say, I would be remiss if I didn't say that what really led to my meeting Ryan was meeting one of our executive producers, Sherry Marsh, who is also a producer on the show Vikings on the History Channel. And she and I met and we just had a wonderful, it was one of those odd meetings where we chatted for 2 hours. And unlike every other exec who I'd ever met, she just seemed to really understand the material and she understood what my intention was with wanting to tell this story. And so Sherry and I spent about a month working on a pitch for Pose, and then we went out with it, and she's known Ryan for several years, and, you know, Ryan received the script, and he said, I want to meet this writer, and I want to hear the pitch, and so we met for about 45 minutes, and he was already developing a show in this world, and so it was perfect timing to meet with him, and Brad and Ryan are just wonderful human beings, and I think they're really, truly committed to seeing the landscape of television shift.
Like a lot of LGBTQ people today, the people in your story are often marginalized and they're often, you know, attacked for who they are. But you also go out of your way in the series to make sure that there are moments of tenderness and happiness and love. And there's kind of a love story that happens between Stan. He's a white married man from the suburbs who works for Donald Trump's real estate organization, and Angel, who is a brown trans woman. I want to play a clip of a scene between Stan and Angel.
I don't live. I don't believe. I accumulate. I'm a brand. A middle class white guy. But you're who you are. Even though the price you pay for it is being disinvited from the rest of the world. I'm the one playing dress up.
I want to know a little bit more about this scene and this storyline and why you felt it was important.
The essence of what this show is about is baked into the title. The show is called Pose, and we aren't focusing solely on the physical posing that is happening on the ballroom floor, but we're also focused on the posing that we all do within our own lives, you know, who the masks that we wear, who we pretend to be. And I think that that is an experience that is universal. I think we all have had moments where we feel like we are pretending, we're being someone who we aren't, you know. And what was important was for us to show that that experience is universal. You know, I think more often than not, one of the critiques that's lobbed at the trans community is that they're confused. You know, they don't know who they are. And I think what we wanted to explore was what that pretending looks like for cisgendered folks, right? So within the dynamic between Stan and Angel, her narrative isn't one that we often see in film and TV, where she is a woman who is coming into her transness and she isn't sure about her identity. She knows exactly who she is and she knows exactly what she wants. And here now she's met this John, this man, Stan, who has no idea who he is, who's absolutely pretending. And I think that we felt that it was obviously interesting storytelling and subversive, but also true to life.
Stephen, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pose airs Sunday nights on the FX cable channel. Coming up on The Frame, Mo Berg wasn't just a Major League Baseball player, he was also a spy.
KPCC supporters include HBO, presenting Westworld. Live without limits in a world where every human appetite can be indulged. This dark odyssey follows the dawn of artificial consciousness and the evolution of sin. In this hit series, a group of android hosts deviate from their programmer's carefully planned scripts in a disturbing pattern of aberrant behavior. Chaos takes control in the second season of Westworld, Emmy eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
And now the new movie, The Catcher Was a Spy, tells the story of Mo Berg. He went from Major League Baseball to being a spy during World War II. He spoke many languages, practiced law at one point, and the sports press often called him the professor. Paul Rudd plays Mo Berg, and the film is directed by Ben Lewin. He previously made the film The Sessions. When Lewin joined me at KPCC, we talked about the real-life Mo Berg, starting with his time in the major leagues.
His baseball career was a perfect example of how he could overcome mediocrity. I wish other people would take an example from it. But he was 15 years in the major league, and I think that image of him as the professor, the sports press just loved him. He not only went to law school, he did actually practice law to some extent. But he spoke maybe 9, 10, uncertain quite how many languages he did speak and how well he spoke them. But he had a photographic memory, and he was an extraordinary scholar.
He was famous for reading as many as 10 newspapers a day. And he was also someone I think we would call, right, in today's language, he had obsessive compulsive disorder. If anybody touched his newspapers, he had to go out and buy a new one because he felt it had been somehow soiled. Was he kind of, idiosyncratic seems like too kind a word, was he a strange man in some ways?
I think today he would be described as being on the Asperger spectrum. I mean, really, there are so many components of that. His wearing the same clothes every day, the black suit and the black tie and the white shirt, and his obsession with not having anyone touch his newspapers. It wasn't only the fact that he read all those newspapers, but there was a kind of a body language associated with it. And I certainly formed the opinion, so did Paul Rudd, which we tried to build into the performance a bit, that there was something autistic about him.
In 1934, Mo Berg was in Japan with some other American baseball players. And the scene is in your film, and it's actually something that actually happened.
Yes.
He put on a kimono, got a bunch of flowers, was pretending to go visit somebody in the hospital, but actually had something else in mind. What did he do when he went to the hospital with these flowers to visit somebody he wasn't actually going to visit?
Well, he was supposedly visiting the American ambassador's daughter who was having a baby, and that was the cover. And his purpose was to go to the top of what was then the tallest building in Tokyo, the American Hospital, and film the naval installations in Tokyo Harbor, which was something he should not have been doing. And there was quite a lot of sensitivity about that. And why he thought that a 6'2" Jewish guy in a kimono would look inconspicuous, I have no idea.
And this is in 1934, well before Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And the film that he took didn't ultimately prove to be like hugely useful, but I think Doolittle's team did review it before their raid on Tokyo. Was that the first inkling that maybe he saw himself doing something beyond baseball?
Well, you know, there is a certain amount of debate and speculation as to whether he was already a spy working for the government or whether he was freelancing. My own sense is that he was freelancing, which makes it even more crazy that you think, oh, well, how do I become a spy? And in fact, he invented the protocol on how you become a spy. And whether or not the film featured in the Doolittle raid, it certainly was a calling card.
It was. And in 1941, he was asked to join the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which later became the CIA. What did the government see in Mo, and what did Mo want to do for the government?
You know, you have to put this in the context of the other people they were recruiting for the OSS as well. People like Julia Child, for example. What is a tall female chef doing working for a spy service? And you ask the same question about a tall Jewish baseball player. And I think that Donovan was at his time, a very creative man.
This is General Bill Donovan.
General Bill Donovan, who recruited him, yes. Yes. I think that he had an instinct for people with imagination. I think that he realized that the people he was going to throw into the field needed the ability to make decisions as they went along, not to be like ordinary foot soldiers, but to be innovators. And so people like Moberg appealed to him.
He was somebody who pretended as a spy to be somebody other than who he was. And in real life, the record's ambiguous, but you certainly suggest in your film he may have been a different person in real life than he was to his teammates, and that is, he might have been a gay man. How did you wrestle with that, and why do you think that's an important aspect of his life to illuminate?
We did wrestle with it, and just kind of straight-washing the guy was not really telling the story. I read all the letters that his girlfriend wrote to him and saw a dramatic change in their relationship. I talked to a lady who dated Mo in the 1950s. Bob Rodat talked to
your screenwriter. Yep.
Yeah, a man who had had a relationship with Mo. I mean, I thought that there was something inherently relevant about a man who had his own personal secrets, feeling that being a spy was almost part of his personality. And I came to the conclusion, insofar as I could come to a conclusion, that he was bisexual.
Ben Lewin is the director of The Catcher Was a Spy. It is in theaters starting today. Ben, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be with you again.
And that is it for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett. Our intern is Maria Alexa Cavanaugh, and our engineer is Valentina Rivera. Special thanks to my doctor for the antibiotics. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. Join us back here on Monday.